In the preceding session, we were looking at the overview which you see on the screen this morning, and I had sought to point out the events which transpired since the time of eternity before the creation of the world to the period of silence after the writing of the book of Malachi prior to the birth of Jesus Christ. So we do not need to go over that again this morning, except that some of you didn't see it last night, and I apologize that you will be somewhat at a loss as we proceed into the next events. But in a few moments, we'll continue this overview of prophecy, this time continuum on which we live, and we'll be dealing this morning primarily with events which are yet to come. Last night, we were discussing history, the events which have already transpired. Remember that in order to properly get out of this study what you should, you definitely do need to get the book, The Promise of His Coming, and read it. And you should read it while the study is going on. I have people come to me after a prophecy conference and say, thank you for having me to read the book first, because reading it before you spoke was very helpful in understanding what you were talking about. You also may want to order the tapes of these sessions. They're being done live. There are 10 sessions. You can order those tapes through us, and we will send them to you along with the charts, which I am using in the teaching discourse here. I have tapes on the prophecy conference already, but I'm doing them again because we're having longer sessions here, and I'm bringing it more up to date. Now, as I look at this overview, which I did last night, I'm reminded that what was happening here with God and His creation in the attempts or the overtures of divine love again and again with different people such as Adam, Noah, Abraham, Moses, Joshua, and David, each event having failed to produce what God wanted to produce on the earth with His creation, I'm reminded of something that happens often at my house. If I put myself in the position of God, and I put my grandchildren in the position of Adam and Noah and these other men, then you will understand what I'm about to say by way of illustration. My grandchildren come to see us, and the first thing they do when they come in the door is they get the sack of toys out of the closet, and they turn the sack upside down, and the toys go everywhere. And they have a wonderful time playing with the toys. But the one thing they don't like is putting them away. And so we have to say again and again, clean up your mess, clean up your toys, put them away, and eventually, either granddaddy or daddy, as the case may be, will get down on the floor and will say to himself, if you want a job done, you have to do it yourself. That's what God said. God had tried again and again and again and again, but they kept making a mess out of His creation, and nobody was able to clean it up. So finally God said, after this 445 years of silence between the Old and New Testaments, God said, I will go down and clean it up for them. This is what the word means when it says, the word was made flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld His glory full of grace and truth. So, in essence, God has given to us a brand new world. He gave us a new world at the beginning. But after we had literally destroyed it with our pollution and our evil and our wickedness, then God proceeded to give us the world renewed in Jesus Christ. And please note that in the coming of Jesus Christ, we have God's seventh attempt, number seven. The attempt is number seven. There have been six here. This is the human number, but the number seven is the divine number, the number of completion and perfection. So that God Himself now proceeds to do the divine thing and to bring about the solution to the mess in the world. Now, the tragedy is that even though Jesus Christ has come and God has set about to take over the world again and to get rid of the mess which we have created, even though Christ has come, we're over here somewhere now on this time continuum, 2,000 or so years later, and the world is literally in a mess again, as we well know. The first time when Jesus came, He came to clean house with love. That's what the incarnation was all about. That's what John 3:16 is all about. God loved the world, which was in a mess, so much that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish but have everlasting life. The next time he comes, however, and he will come again, the next time he comes, he will not come in love, but he will come in judgment. Judgment will be the eighth day. We'll talk more about that later. The eighth day of creation. We've had 6 days of creation, the seventh day of rest, the coming of Jesus Christ, who is the rest of God, and then we have the beginning of a new creation, like a new Monday morning, when God creates the kingdom upon the earth during the millennial reign, which is yet to be. Now, I am overviewing this very generally here, and I'm not talking about specifics, so I'm sure that I'm leaving some of you in the dark at the moment. But we'll talk about the specifics as we move along. If you reject, if you and I reject the first overture of God's love in the person of Jesus Christ, if we reject him, then we have to face the second coming of Christ in judgment at the end of the age. If we accept the first coming of Jesus Christ by faith, then the second coming of judgment has no bearing upon us, because we have already been judged in Jesus Christ upon his cross. The first coming of Jesus Christ is the solution to the sin of the world, but the solution does not become meaningful or does not accomplish the task for which it happened until you and I, by faith, receive that into our hearts. So this gives us some general idea as to where we are and what's going on in this overview. Now, let me put the second one on the screen, and we'll see where we go from here. This is, of course, a continuation. Here we have the birth of Jesus Christ, and the little cross on the line continuum simply refers to the crucifixion of Jesus, and then you see an arrow pointing upward with the word ascension. This is when Christ returned back to the Father, and it was at this point that the church age began. This is called the age or the period of the Gentiles, because the church was a Gentile thing primarily. Jews and Gentiles both in it, but it was started in order to fill in this chasm or this vacancy, this mess, clean up this mess which the Jews had done. So God started with a new thing here. And we have the church age beginning with the ascension of Jesus Christ, and we are in the church age. As long as we are in this world before Christ comes to evacuate his church, we are in the age of the Gentiles or in the church age. The problem was that after Jesus was born, he was rejected. And the result of that was we had an increasing apostasy, just like we had in all six of those events in the Old Testament historical account which I gave you. And the increasing apostasy continues until this present day and will continue until the end of the 7 years of tribulation, at which time Christ will come in judgment to clean up the mess once and for all and begin the millennial reign. Now, somewhere along here where we are living, and I think we're living in the last days, just immediately prior to or preceding the coming of Christ for his church, somewhere along here we are waiting, watching the signs of the times, believing that Jesus is going to return in the heavens, and the church, the Christian church, from this period of 2,000 years, is going to be caught up to be with him in the air, and so shall we ever be with the Lord. That is, of course, in a generic sense, a part of the second coming of Christ. When we talk about the second coming, we're usually talking about what happens here at the end of the 7 years of tribulation, when Christ comes all the way down to the earth and establishes his kingdom and destroys wickedness and sin forever. But this, too, is a kind of a preview or a foretaste of the second coming of Christ when he comes for his church and the church is caught up to be with him in the air. This is the time when the graves of the Christians will be opened, and every person during this period who has accepted Christ and died will be raised from the dead and joined with those who are caught up alive and transformed by some kind of divine metamorphosis to have a glorified body to be with Christ in the air. Now, what follows that is what is referred to usually as the Great Tribulation. And that is a 7-year period, very graphically pointed out in the Scriptures, both Old and New Testaments, a 7-year period, actual, literal 7 years upon the earth, which will be the most difficult period the world has ever known, because the church will be gone, and those who were not prepared to meet Christ when he comes will be left upon the earth for 7 years to live under the rule and reign of the most wicked ruler the world has ever seen, namely the beast or the Antichrist. Now, Daniel tells us, and John in Revelation tells us, that this period of 7 years will be divided into two segments of 3.5 years each. And the first 3.5 years is not going to be as terrifically bad as the last 3.5 years, because something happens in the middle which really makes it much more difficult. So the Great Tribulation is a term that literally describes the last 3.5 years, though usually we use it as in generically to describe the whole period. In the first 3.5 years, there will be an invasion of the land of Israel, the Palestinian nation, an invasion from the north country of Russia, and most of the army of Russia will be destroyed during this period. Who else will be with Russia? We are not sure. There will be other nations who will join in with that battle. This will happen soon after the coming of Christ for his church. During the 3.5 year period, the first half of the 7 years of tribulation, the temple will be rebuilt in Jerusalem. There is no temple there now. There hasn't been a temple there since 70 A.D. when the Romans destroyed the temple and destroyed the land. But the temple will be rebuilt, and sacrifices will be reinstated in the temple, and the priest will officiate in the temple. And this will be because things will be as they were before the coming of Christ for the Jewish people. They will have a temple, they will have sacrifices, they will have priests. In all of this, they will be being prepared for the coming of their Messiah. Because remember, their Messiah, in their minds, has not yet come. We're looking for the second coming of the Messiah. They're looking for the first coming of the Messiah. So, according to the prophetic scriptures, the prophetic clock, which stopped here with the crucifixion of Jesus, in order for the church age to intervene, as Daniel tells us, the prophetic clock will start again, and things will be as they were during the 7 year period of tribulation upon the earth. So the temple will be rebuilt. We'll talk about that later as to how that might happen, what will happen to the Dome of the Rock, which is built where the temple used to stand, etc. During the first 3.5 years, there will be 144,000 Jews who constitute what the Old Testament calls the remnant. 144,000 Jews, 12,000 out of each of the 12 tribes of Israel, who will be sealed by God with God's seal, whatever that may be, and we'll discuss that later. And they will be God's representatives or evangelists or missionaries, and they will do what they were supposed to do during the days of the Old Testament but failed so miserably to perform. They will be, during the 7 years, the missionaries of God to lead these people who are left behind when Christ returns. They will lead many of these people to accept Jesus as their Messiah. In the middle of that 7 year period, Daniel tells us that something terrible is going to happen. The Antichrist, who is revealing himself during this period, is upon the throne and ruling one empire of the whole world. The Antichrist is going to betray the treaty which he has made with the Jews, and treaties are always being made with the Jews. They're being made now. He is going to betray his treaty, betray the Jews, and he is going to climb upon the temple steps and enter the temple which has been rebuilt and announce himself God. He is the Antichrist. He will claim to be God. And when that happens, Jesus says, when you see the abomination of desolation take place, then you know that the end is just around the corner. Following that, things are going to fall apart. And then he will demand the mark of the beast. If you're going to buy or sell or do business or even eat, you'll have to have the mark of the beast upon your head and upon your hand. The two witnesses, namely Moses and Elijah, will be witnessing during this period and protected by God as they, along with the 144,000, seek to bring these people to accept the Messiah. And many of them will accept the Messiah, but most of them who do will be put to death. Some will probably escape, though the Bible doesn't tell us this specifically, toward the end of the 7 years of tribulation, because the Antichrist will be losing his hold, and some will slip through the cracks, so to speak. At the end of the 7 years of tribulation, there will be a terrible conflict between the nations of the world called the Battle of Armageddon. And immediately following the Battle of Armageddon, and incidentally, that is a word that's used quite freely anymore. Not just religious people talk about Armageddon. Military people talk about Armageddon. Educators talk about it. Everybody talks about it. Everybody knows what it is, and everybody's expecting it to come soon. The Battle of Armageddon. Following the Battle of Armageddon, Christ will come from the heavens, and he will defeat the forces of wickedness, and those who have accepted Christ during this period will be raised from the dead to join those who were raised here at the beginning of the 7 years, and they will be in the New Jerusalem, as John tells it. The New Jerusalem is both a place and a people. And the New Jerusalem, John says, he saw up above the earth coming down like a beautiful city to the earth during the millennial reign. We will be in the New Jerusalem during the 7 years as Christians, and we will be enjoying the marriage supper of the Lamb. 7 years, there will be a banquet and a nuptial feast when Jesus Christ and the bride, which is the church, are joined together in this symbolic marriage of God and his people. After that comes the 1,000 years millennial reign, during which time Satan will be bound in a prison. The wicked angels, fallen angels, are bound in what is known in the New Testament as Tartarus. It is not Hades, and it is not hell. More about that later, too. The New Jerusalem, during this time, will be coming down, but not to the earth, because the glorified bodies of the Christians in the New Jerusalem, though they have access to the earth, those upon the earth will still be human beings, fallen creatures, and they will not have access to the New Jerusalem yet. At the end of the 1,000 years, when nobody will die except those who rebel against the rule of Jesus Christ upon the throne, nobody will die. At the end of that period, there will be a population explosion, because here you have 144,000 people plus those who are converted during the tribulation, who will begin the millennial period, and they will marry and have children, and the world will be probably as big in population as it is now. And at the end of that 1,000 years, Satan has been bound, everything has been good under the rule of the Christ, except that everybody who was born during this period is a sinner. And they will be ruled with a hand of iron, the Bible says, which means that Christ will rule by force to ensure righteousness and peace and prosperity during this period. And those who rebel will be put to death. Otherwise, you'll live for 1,000 years, which is a return to the age of the patriarchs in the Old Testament, the very beginning of the creation of the world. So the 1,000 years is the restoration of the kingdom of God, which was offered to Abraham, and the Jews refused by their actions. The restoration of the kingdom of God for 1,000 years. At the end of the 1,000 years, there will be a final conflict, during which time Satan, who has been bound here, will be released from his prison house in order to give everybody who was born during this period an equal chance with those who were born before to either accept or reject Jesus Christ. And masses of them will reject Jesus Christ, even though the rule has been benevolent, and good, because that's just human nature. We always think we can improve on what God does. So the conflict will ensue, and the devil will have his chance. At the end of that, he will be cast into hell forever, and the white throne judgment will commence, at which time the wicked will stand before the white throne judgment of God and will receive their sentence, and if their name is not written in the Lamb's Book of Life, they will be cast into hell. The righteous, who are already here with the Lord, and those who have accepted him during this period, will not worry about the judgment, the white throne judgment, because they have already been judged in Jesus Christ. But they will stand at the judgment of works, which is the Bema, or the judgment seat of Christ. Everybody will stand before that judgment, which is the judgment that determines our position in heaven or our position in hell. And that depends upon our faithfulness or lack of it. But our entrance into heaven and hell depends upon one thing only, and that is what we have done with Jesus Christ. Have we accepted him or rejected him? And this, of course, here is the heavenly realm or heavenly reign, which is forever, and we're back where we were at the beginning when I talked about God and eternity before the creation of the world. This is what the Bible says. Now, my friends, I know that some of us find this to be very meticulous. It is meticulous. God is a meticulous God. God has planned out everything in detail. He wouldn't be God if he hadn't. There are no loose ends with God. from the very beginning, God knew what he was doing, what he was planning. He knew what the end would be. And he has made it clear to us. I say clear to us, at least it's clear to some of us, and others find it not so clear. That's why we have prophecy conferences, so that we can elaborate on these things and show you what the scriptures say. There is not a thing that I have mentioned on this chart this morning or the chart yesterday evening that you cannot prove from the scriptures. It's right there in black and white. So let us get our heads together and let us refuse to say to ourselves, well, I don't want to bother with all that. I don't believe all this stuff. It's not stuff. It has to do with your eternal destiny. And even though you don't fully understand it, that will not keep you out of heaven. Even if you don't understand it, you have to recognize that you are at a disadvantage, because the more you understand about the purpose and plan of God, the better you're going to be as a Christian, the more devoted you're going to be in your discipleship. The less you understand, or the less you want to understand about these things, the freer you're going to be in your lackadaisical attitude toward God and what God has planned for the creation of his world. So we are here in a panorama of biblical history and prophecy. Now, where do we go from here? We're beginning what I call History and Prophecy 101. So I want you to understand from the outset that we are not going to cover everything in this prophecy conference. That would be impossible, regardless as to how long we were here together. I want you also to understand that this is not a course in comparative theology. We're not here to discuss different views and different ideas of theology. We're not here to argue about those things or even debate those things. That's not it. We're not even here to discuss comparative eschatology. And you know as well as I do that there are different views about the details of the prophecy which I have just been describing to you. Fitzgerald says in his book, The Crack-Up, the test of a first-rate intelligence is the ability to hold two opposing ideas in the mind at the same time and still retain the ability to function. Now, on the basis of what Fitzgerald said there, let me illustrate that. I believe that God is a God of all power, and I believe that God is a God of all love. In other words, I believe he is a God who has all the power in the world, can do anything he wants, and he's a God who has all love. Now, the question is, if God is a powerful God and he doesn't do anything about the problems in the world, then he doesn't love us. The other is, if God is a loving God and can do anything he wants to do and he doesn't, then he doesn't have the power to do it. So you see, you've got two opposing ideas. If you can keep those two opposing ideas in your mind and still keep your balance, then Fitzgerald says you're a pretty good person. Now, I want you to know this morning that I'm conversant with all of the views of prophecy, and there are a lot of them. All of these are going round and round in my head when I talk to you about these things. For example, there are those who say there's nothing to prophecy. It's all fantasy. It's all fairy tales. I know about that view, and I know why they take that view. Then there are the preterists, they are called, who say about prophecy, it all happened in the past. It happened during the days of the first century. When John writes the book of Revelation, he's talking about things that happened in his own day. It's over and done. I know that view, and I know why they take that view. And then there's some who say, well, the whole thing is symbolic. It simply means that this kind of stuff has been going on since the beginning of time. It's the whole history or the story of the Church of Jesus Christ. It's always in trouble. And it happens again and again and again. So it's a symbolic thing. And then there are those who are futurists who believe that the whole story of prophecy is something that is yet to happen in the future. It hasn't even begun to happen yet. We're in the beginning of those days, but it's all still future. Now, it's interesting to go back in history and discover that when Constantine became emperor of the Roman Empire in the 4th century, things began to deteriorate in the church. Prior to the time of Constantine, and prior to the time of Augustine, who also came in the 4th century, prior to the time of these two men, one a political ruler and one a religious leader, the church believed what I put on this board. This was the teaching of the early church in the first 300 years or so of its existence. When Constantine came to the throne, he claimed that he had seen a cross upon the azure blue sky when he was fighting, And he believed that God had given him the victory, so therefore he said to the pagan Roman Empire, we're no longer going to be pagans, we're going to be Christians. Everybody become a Christian. So everybody became a Christian, nominally. And that was the worst thing that had happened to the Christian church in the first 300 years. When you have an emperor, a state-controlling emperor, who decides to make Christianity the ruling religion of the empire, that is a horrible thing, because people become Christians who are not Christians, and the church begins to deteriorate, and it began to deteriorate then. At the same time, there was a man named Augustine, and Augustine had a conversion experience, and no one questions that. He was a great man. He was a devoted follower of God, and today you will hear him quoted both in the Protestant churches and in the Roman Catholic Church as one of the greatest Christians who ever lived. No question about that. But he was misguided about something. And the thing he was misguided about was this. He decided, on the basis of the reading of Origen, who had existed before him some time before, he decided that we were misinterpreting the Bible because we were using it wrong. That we shouldn't take the Bible literally, which is what I'm doing here, but we should take the Bible figuratively. We should read it spiritually. We should read it as a symbol, and nothing more than a symbol, metaphorically. And the church began to do that. And the result of that was that from the 7th century to the 12th century, we had a deterioration of theological belief and understanding of the Bible during what was known as the Dark Ages, the darkest period the world has ever known, morally and spiritually and politically. And then from the 12th century until the 16th century, we had the period of scholasticism, when coming out of the Dark Ages, we began to become intellectuals and rethink all of this. But it was a humanistic period. And the result of the scholastic period from the 12th century to the 16th century brought about the need for the Reformation in the 16th century under Martin Luther. And it was not until the 18th century that we have a restoration of biblical prophecy as it was understood by the church in the first 300 years before the time of the political leader Constantine and the church leader Augustine. I've given you some history this morning. It's all in the book. I'm sure you're not going to remember all of this stuff, but this is so important to understand why we are where we are. Why it is that now, all of a sudden, in the last few years, this prophecy concept has become full-blown. It's because we're rediscovering the truth of the early church. It had been lost for so long. And even in the 18th century, when we began to restore it, it was only in small sectarian groups where the idea began to flower, and the rest of the world sort of laughed at the whole concept. But now, the whole world is beginning to recognize that the truth which the early church had is the truth which we still have today. So this is History and Prophecy 101. It's an overview. If we had several years to spend together, we would probably deal with History and Prophecy 201 and History and Prophecy 301 and History and Prophecy 401, and I suppose we'd never graduate. One-fourth of the Bible is prophecy. 25%, Old Testament, New Testament, is prophecy. Therefore, how can anyone even begin to suggest that God does not want us to understand prophecy if 25% of everything that God has said to us is about prophecy? First, what's the difference between history and prophecy? Well, in 1947, as a result of the Balfour Declaration in England, it was decided by the United Nations that the Israelites, the Jews, needed a state of their own. And so they decided to give Israel land in ancient Palestine where they had originally been. That was in 1947. That was prophecy. In 1948, the state was founded. It was established. And that became history. So you see, there's a fine line between what is prophecy and what is history. History is the fulfillment of prophecy, and prophecy is history yet unwritten. Two sides of the same event. When I think about history, I'm reflecting on something that happened in the past. When I talk about prophecy, I am predicting or thinking of predicting something that's going to happen in the future. But it's the same thing in the sight of God. Because with God, there is no past and there is no future. Now put that in your heads and keep it there because that's a basic truth. With God, there is no past and there is no future. when Moses asked God, "Who are you and what is your name so that I may tell Pharaoh lest he kick me out of the palace before I get started? Who are you?" God said, "Tell him I am."
He didn't say, "Tell him I was, I am, and I will be." God said, "You tell him I am," which means I am the eternal one. I am the God who is. I am the God not who was and shall be, but the God who is. I am the God who lives in the present. I am the God of the now. God is the same yesterday, today, and forever.
And so Simon Peter says in his second epistle, "Do not forget this one thing, that with the Lord one day is as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years as one day." God is timeless, he is eternal, and he doesn't see things in bits and pieces. When we talk about history and prophecy, we're talking about something that is behind us, something that is before us, and something that exists right now in front of us, because that's the way we are. We are confined by space and time. God has made us creatures of space and time. But God is not a creature of space and time. I think I have done this before, but let's do it again, because sometimes a picture is worth 1,000 words. This is what we mean when we talk about the foreknowledge of God or the predestined will of God. When we talk about God being in the now and having no past and no future. Here is my line continuum, my life continuum again. And let's say this is a street in downtown New York and they're having a parade. Now already some of you remember my having done this before, I think. They're having a parade on the street in downtown New York. That's a long parade, maybe 5 miles long. And there's a little boy standing here by the side of the road and he's watching the parade go by. Now, he is seeing what his eyes permit him to see. He is seeing what is before him. His eyes perceive only so much. There's a limit as to what he could see in that parade. Some of it he's already seen, and he's gone by. He can't see it anymore. And some of it he hasn't seen yet because it hasn't gotten there. But if you take the little boy and you put him on the top of the Empire State Building, then the little boy sees the whole parade at the same time. You have to shift in your mind here from a spatial concept to a temporal concept. We're not talking about space, we're talking about time. So if this is God looking at the events which transpire in history, he doesn't see it as we do because we do not have his perspective. We see only bits and pieces of what's happening in the world. But with God, he sees it all from the beginning. Because there's no difference in the beginning or the end with God. He is the eternal I am, sees it all. So, when we talk about God having foreknowledge, we're talking about something that we do. We have foreknowledge. And the only way we know how to describe God is to give him the same attributes that we have. In other words, we anthropologically say about God, he reaches down and touches us as though God has a hand like I do. Or we talk about God seeing things as though God has an eye like I have. We do not know what God is. We do know that God is not just a big man. We do know that God is the spiritual creator and redeemer of everything which he has made and loves. And we do know that God is always the same. We know that God knows everything. We know that he has all power. He has all wisdom. These things we know about God. But it is beyond the scope of our finite minds to begin to describe that fully. But this, I think, will help you to understand when I say that history and prophecy are the same thing. We just see it a little time. But with God, it's all the same thing. He looks at what we know as the past and the future as one and the same thing. The latest heresy in the Christian church, and you may not have heard about this, you will. The latest heresy is taking place, believe it or not, in some of our more evangelical seminaries and institutions of theological learning. It's not happening necessarily in the liberal schools where it usually happens, but it's happening among those who have held to the authority of the scriptures. And do you know what is being taught? It is called open theism. And open theism is a new idea. It is the idea that God doesn't know everything,
God changes his mind. God has to adjust to things as they happen. And it's based on those passages in the Scripture which say God repented that he had done something. Several of those there. This is not a theological course, so I don't have time to go into all of that. But I'm saying that this is a heresy to say that God changes his mind. God never changes his mind. He knows everything. It all happens at once. He simply tells us that we live in this span of time and space where we are limited by our knowledge of both time and space. And he deals with us on that basis because we're finite creatures, but he is an infinite God. So when I talk to you about prophecy or history, I'm talking about one and the same thing. And there's no reason why we should get upset because prophecy seems so strange to us, because what I'm doing is telling you what God says is going to happen because God already sees it. Now, have you absorbed that? Is that settled down in your gray matter? Zephaniah warned the people of his day in the 7th century B.C. that the Chaldeans were coming. And nobody in Israel believed him. And yet the Chaldeans came, and they were carried away into Babylonian captivity. 600 years later, Jesus warned the Jews that the Romans were coming, but nobody believed it. And yet in 70 AD, the Romans, under the plundering armies of Titus, came and destroyed the temple and destroyed the nation of Israel. 2,000 years later, we are hearing voices like mine, many voices across the land, who are saying that civilization is at its demise. We are dying as a civilization. Not as a nation or an empire, but as a civilization. The Gulf War and the terroristic attack on 9/11 were simply symptoms of the dying of civilization, the death and decay of our culture and our way of life. These were attacks not on a nation per se, but these have become attacks on civilization itself. And political leaders all over the world now are trying to get together to work something out because they are aware that if we do not solve this problem, it's not that one nation is going to beat up on another one, it's rather that we're going to destroy ourselves, everything. It's an attack on civilization. Everything that happens anymore is a warning from the hand of God. It's happened again and again in history. It happened in England, it happened in France, and in Spain, and in Germany, and in Babylon, and in Africa, and in Assyria, and in Egypt. Go back and read your history. It's happened again and again, and every time God has warned. John Quincy Adams once made a statement which needs to be repeated in our day. It is this. He said, "There never was a democracy yet that did not commit suicide." I think he's right. Read your history. We are on the verge, as a civilization, of committing suicide. And I think that that has to do, that it has a definite relationship with the whole idea of prophecy and the coming of Christ and the end of the world. The West is a degenerating culture. You know that, and I know that. We are rapidly degenerating as a culture. In Ernest Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, he lists 5 reasons for the collapse of that empire. The Roman Empire, during its heyday, never dreamed that it could ever end. It was a superpower. And the Roman Empire was very much like the Titanic. You know, nobody ever believed that the Titanic could sink. In fact, they said it is an unsinkable ship. And yet on its maiden voyage in 1912, the unthinkable happened and the ship went down. And you know that story as well as I do. Well, the Roman Empire was like a giant Titanic. Nothing can happen to us. We're invulnerable. We cannot die. And yet Gibbon said it did die, and it died for 5 basic reasons. Gibbons was a great historian, as you well know. He said, first of all, the Roman Empire died because of decadent morality. Now, the Romans believed in God. In fact, they believed in lots of gods. They had gods, and they had goddesses, and they had religious temples, which were actually nothing more than brothels.
The Roman Empire was engaged in something that is deplorable to us today. They were engaged in infanticide. If they had children they didn't want, they just took them out and left them by the roadside until they were destroyed by the elements and nobody paid any attention to it. We deplore that because we do it more scientifically now with abortion. The Roman Empire fell because of decadent morality, because it was a homosexual empire. Educators, philosophers, and statesmen, almost all of them, had their homosexual relationships, and it was accepted. The family was denigrated, and marriage was unimportant in the Roman Empire, and we know that the nation is built on the home, and no nation can long exist without the solidity of the foundation of the family and the home that was instituted by God in the book of Genesis. I've made you male and female, and for this reason, a man shall leave his mother and father and shall cling to his wife, and they shall become one flesh, and you shall reproduce as families upon the earth. The second reason why Gibbon said the Roman Empire fell was because of exorbitant taxation. Now, if you go back and read about Rome, you'll discover that in Rome there was a lot of deficit spending, there was a lot of political corruption, there were all kinds of governmental pork barrels, and they spent and spent and spent, and welfare was all out of balance, and they threw money at every problem they had. Does that sound like anybody you ever heard of yet? You know where taxation came from? It came from Joseph. Joseph was the first one to instill taxation on people. He was in Egypt. He was the governor. And he told the king of Egypt there was going to be a great famine for 7 years, and they needed to put some stuff away. So he suggested to the Pharaoh that they tax the people. And they taxed the people. 20% of all of their grain and their income, they were taxed, and they put that into storehouses so that there would be something in an emergency when the day did come. Today, we pay over 50% of our income in taxes. Did you know that the kingdom of Israel, the United Kingdom of David and Solomon, when it broke apart under Jeroboam and Rehoboam, did you know why it broke apart? Let me tell you why. It's because Solomon had overtaxed his people. Go back and read your Old Testament. He had taxed them to the point that it was so burdensome they could not handle it, and they were complaining. And when Solomon died, Rehoboam, his son, took his place, and Jeroboam, the military captain who was leading the 10 northern tribes to secede against Solomon and Rehoboam's empire, came to Rehoboam and said, "You've got to do something about the taxes. They're killing us. You've got to reduce our taxes." Rehoboam said, "I will not reduce your taxes. I will make them heavier." And Jeroboam said, "We're gone." And the nation broke apart because of overtaxation. This was a part of the reason, Gibbon says, the Roman Empire fell. Then he said, in the third place, there was overweening thirst for pleasure. Look at it again. And look at our own land. Look at the world today. Pleasure is a way of life. They had sports arenas all over the Roman Empire. Not just the Colosseum in Rome. Colosseum in Rome was one of the wonders of the world. It seated 55,000 people. But they had arenas like that for sports all over the Roman Empire. And life had become literally a game. And much money was invested in this game. It was a sadistic game. They liked to go to the arenas and watch the animals tear each other apart. They loved that. And they would scream as the blood would flow. And no wonder the time came when they put the Christians out there. And they let the lions tear them apart. They were bloodthirsty people. This was the way they enjoyed life. And this was their excitement. Today, if you go to Indianapolis 500, you don't really enjoy it unless there's a wreck and somebody gets beat up. And then you really get excited. If you go to a boxing match, you love it when somebody's nose gets bloodied or somebody's down, knocked out. That's wonderful. We love it. Gibbon said it was this overweening thirst for pleasure which was a part of the reason for the destruction of the Roman Empire. And then he said the fourth reason was a massive system of weaponry. They had a false sense of security. They were overconfident. They thought they had the best army in the world, and they did. They said, "We've got the best, fastest chariots, we've got the sturdiest battle axes, we've got the best trained soldiers, we've got the best arms, nobody can defeat us." And today, look at the nations of the world, and especially the United States. We are masters at technological warfare. We are all engaged in an arms race. Who can build the biggest and meanest weapon? I will build mine, and then, of course, you're going to build yours. And the more I build, the more you build. So we catch ourselves in a catch-22 situation. And the United States is still, at this point, the superpower of the world. It's not going to be forever. I'm glad, of course, that we are the superpower because I'm here, and that gives me some sense of relief to know what's happening in the world, that we're the superpower. But if you watch TV in the evenings, if you watch what's been happening in Afghanistan, if you watch what happened in the Gulf War, you know that this superpower of the United States can literally pulverize the world. That's how strong and powerful we are.